Welcome to episode 5 of the Jordan Innovation Lab philosophy podcast, Corrupting the Youth. Today's guests are Patrick, JD, and Hunter. They are all sophomores at Jordan High School, and they all play Ultimate Frisbee. Could each of you guys introduce yourselves and then talk a little bit about your religious background and your overall outlook on life?
My name is Patrick. My religious background is, I haven't had much to do with religion in my life. I think I've gone to church maybe 3 or 4 times. I'm a Catholic. I was baptized at birth. Besides that, that's about it.
My name's Hunter. I just started playing Ultimate Frisbee this year. Yeah, it's very fun. I've been enjoying my time in the community here at Jordan. I haven't really been raised in any specific religious background or uprising. My parents decided, because they both came from different religious backgrounds, to raise me neutral. And my overall outlook on life is pretty good. That's about all for me.
My name is JD Woodruff. Religiously, I've been a Baptist Christian my whole life. My dad was Catholic and my mom was Baptist. My parents grew up and their grandparents all Christian. I was baptized at age 11 by choice. I still regularly go to church. I feel like Christianity is a big part of my life. You know, it's just something that I've always considered going into like social circumstances, or like when people ask me about like what religion means to me, it's always one of the first things that comes to mind, or like how I look, my outlook on life. And then, you know, I've been playing Frisbee for what, sixth grade, 5 years. And, you know, something that I always really appreciated about Frisbee is the community. And, you know, just like everyone's so close, and everyone is one of the few communities where there's no, like, almost no hate. Everyone appreciates each other and accepts each other. I think that's like a really valuable thing that, you know, Ultimate Frisbee brings to the table. And I tend to go through life as an outlook of just like trying to appreciate life and show that everyone is important and that you should care for everyone because they deserve it and God cares for them, so you should too.
Do you guys think that you should care about everyone equally, or how do you decide how much you care about different people?
I can start us off for us. I feel like the idea of caring for everyone equally is something that can never be obtained realistically, because as a human, you will always have bias towards not only yourself, but also the ones you love. That's like saying you care about everyone equally would be expecting someone to kill their own father to save 2 random people they've never seen in their life, which is absurd to, I would assume, anyone. So I think the idea of caring for everyone equally isn't something that ever actually is obtained or is reasonable to even imagine as a way of life.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like it's impossible to care for everyone equally. You should care for people, but you always have biases towards people, and there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, do you think that the biases that people have towards other people who aren't their loved ones are good? Do you think that, like, we're meant to care about some people more, or that that's a flaw and we should try to care about everyone equally? What do you think about that?
I see it as a survival instinct. It's like a wolf and their pack. If a wolf were to care about every other wolf in every other pack as much as they do their own packmates, they would die. But when you stick to your own communities and you stick to your own people and you stick to, like, I'm not saying like that's the way everyone should live, but I think in general it's not a flaw in our evolution. I don't think it's a bad thing.
I agree with Hunter, but I think that one thing I think society has taken advantage of, at least coming post-2000 modern times, is the idea that not everyone is equal and that there is only so many people who you can show love to, that the people outside of that group, the people who you don't know, or the people, different ethnic groups or different religious groups, those people, because you don't know them, you don't have to treat them equally, and they're completely different than you. And I think a better outlook is, like, you can show deeper love and compassion for the people who you know are close to you, your parents, your friends, but then that shouldn't take away from people in outside groups receiving that just as much care and attention from you. Like, if I meet someone, just like, for example, let me give an example, because in the Frisbee community, one thing that is really common is, you know, we play teams from all over the nation. Last August 2023, the 5th through the 7th, I was in Colorado for Youth Club Championships, which is one of the biggest youth tournaments in America. And I met that we played all teams from all over the nation. We played teams from Oregon. We played teams from Colorado. We played teams from Minnesota, Philadelphia, Atlanta, just like Texas, teams from everywhere. And so I was meeting all these new people, people who I don't know, people who have different experiences from different parts of the world. And I met this team from Oregon, and they were like one of the nicest group of people I ever met, because, you know, it's just kind of how the first community works. Everyone's super nice, super accepting. And a big tradition we have is this thing called jersey swaps. And at the end of the tournament, you all, like, you take off your jerseys and you, like, trade them with people from other teams to get, like, the different jerseys, because everyone likes other people's jerseys and they want to, you know, take them home and, like, have different names on their backs because everyone has their last name, and just, like, help them remember how fun the tournament was. So I met this guy from Oregon. His name was Jonathan, and he's really cool. I have his phone number still. We still talk. And he was Hindu, which is, like, a very different religious background that I come from. And so, like, obviously, we don't share the same religious background. He's from Oregon. I'm from North Carolina. Like, you can't get much further than that. But he's one of, like, the nicest people I've ever met. And, like, just the feeling of being able to show someone love and then having shown love back, even though I don't know who they are, and be able to connect on, like, a deeper level through, like, Frisbee, something we both love, was really good. Even though that, like, we may not be someone who I would traditionally include as one of my groups of people that I should show love to. So I think that something society should try to reenact into our daily lives is just the idea of showing everyone love, and showing that everyone deserves to be accepted and cared for, even if they're not someone who you would traditionally, you know, give those feelings to.
That's definitely true, and I've experienced that in my life. When I lived in Vancouver, Canada, I lived in student family housing at the University of British Columbia, and there was people there from, like, all over the world, Brazil, China, Mongolia, lots of places in Europe, really everywhere. And there were so many different cultures, but it just formed into a community where, like, everyone was poor, they were at school, and everyone was really close by in their, like, townhomes. And so, like, if there was one parent outside, they would, like, take care of all the kids, and all the kids knew each other. And like they say, like, you teach hate, you're not, like, born with it. And so, like, all the kids from, like, so many different ethnicities and backgrounds were all just playing together, playing games, playing tag, if you're older, like, playing basketball or manhunt or whatever. And so it's really beautiful. And I wonder what you guys think about the way that the culture is in America, where, like, everyone just stays in their own home. And oftentimes you barely even know your neighbors. Do you think that we're losing something in that community, kind of like a wolf pack, where they all care for each other and they all know each other and love each other, even if they're not just your relatives? Do you think that there's something that's missing in the neighborhood structure in America?
I don't know if I would say there's something missing as much as it is lack of motivation. I know in some of the more like rich and upper class neighborhoods, they have a lot more like communication and a lot more collaboration. For example, my neighborhood, oftentimes I've lived in it for, I want to say, like 12 years now. And every year in around August or October, we have a block party, a neighborhood block party, where they put signs up on the roads and we all come together. We all make food and we all just like throw a party on the road. And there's also, I know this happens in all sorts of neighborhoods, not just mine, but they have neighborhood text threads, things to keep people connected, like when dogs go missing, yada, yada, things get lost. So I think there is some connection lost, but I don't think it's all lost. I think it's just different communities of different people, and different communities of different people have different ways of interacting with each other.
I agree with Hunter. I don't think it's something that we're missing, but I think there's definitely something to be gained. And that a lot of times, it's not that we're missing a vital part of, like, how society should work in connection, but it just takes someone to start connecting with other people to really, like, cause, like, a waterfall of effects. And that everyone will, once that person starts that thing, everyone will start, you know, becoming closer. An example I'm going to give is, for the past, I want to say, all my whole life, so at least 15 years, we've had neighborhood Halloween parties, and like we like have a parade and on Halloween night and walk down the neighborhood. And the person who started that, his name was Sam Poley, and him and his family moved 3 years ago out of our neighborhood. And he was always the one creating those text threads Hunter was talking about, creating those opportunities. And everyone always showed up because everyone loved the idea of connecting. Everyone loved talking to other people, but no one wanted to start it. No one wanted to be the one to initiate all of the connection, because people love connecting, but people don't love doing the effort, get to that close relationship and get to do the work to be able to connect with other people. So I think that a vital thing to take away is just if you want your neighborhood to be closer, neighborhood doesn't have to be just neighborhood, even community. It can be greater than just the people you live around. It can be people in your school or, you know, people that you go to church with or people that you work with, like your fellow employees. They just starting something can lead to like something much greater than if nothing were to happen at all. And it also just takes someone to start it for it to really take off.
I think to be able to create a vibrant community, it just takes someone to take the first step and put the effort in to create said community.
What do you think it takes? Is it just forming some sort of meeting, or also why do you think it's so hard? Why do you think that a lot of communities are not really a community? They just live near each other. They're in the same city. Why do you think that it is awkward, or whatever you want to say about why sometimes people don't take that first step?
I think personally that it's a factor in it is motivation. Also, over time, people have just gotten worse at talking to other people just casually. Like, if you're living in an apartment building, you're majority of the time you're not going to be home because you're going to be out working, so you're not going to see your neighbors. So you're not really going to have that community because you're never going to see anyone else in that community.
Mm-hmm. Per se. I agree with what Patrick is saying. A lot of like modern housing, like apartments, could be shared homes, whatever the form of housing is, neighborhoods, yada yada. They are definitely more separate than they have been in the past. Like, mm-hmm. if you look back in like colonial times, you'd have people all cramped into as much space as they could to fit into like one house, one room, one city. Whereas now we are much more spread apart. Big yards, you know, lots of space, trees if we can.
COVID didn't help either.
Yeah, COVID definitely didn't help with our interaction with each other. But I also think a big reason that we don't interact, like you were saying earlier, is time, energy, social anxiety, like all these factors play a role. It's do you not only have the time to put the work in to help create this community, do you want to, like, motivation for it as well, but then also like do you not fear it going downhill, like being judged, being isolated? Because yeah. as much as we love being part of our communities, we fear being isolated that much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really that's why it's so hard to take the first step, because that first step can either lead to something great, a giant staircase, or you could go tumbling all the way down.
Fear of failure.
Yeah, I think that it's important to have, or what's missing from our neighborhoods in America is that they don't facilitate that. Like, to make it easier to interact with people, for example, when I lived in Canada, there was parks everywhere. Since it was student-friendly housing, there was not cars on the road, so kids would just go out and play. It also helped that the parents were in school, so, like, they weren't exactly on a 9-to-5 schedule. So, like, some of them would always kind of be outside watching their kids. And then there was parks nearby and a commons block, which is just a place where there were events all the time. And I think that it really facilitated people becoming friends and the community. And I feel like you were saying, the big yards and the streets just right down the middle and everyone kind of just working in the day and then being tired in the night, it's hard to solve that, and like all the infrastructure is already in place, but it's tough that I feel like our neighborhoods don't facilitate community.
I feel like a big part of it as well is like exhaustion, because if you think about it, most students, or all students, you go to school, you go from school from what, 8 to 3, 8 to 9 to 4. So that's like at least 8 hours. You're interacting with people all day. You have to. You're interacting with your classmates. You're interacting with teachers. Then you have most people have extra after school, like extracurriculars or before school or clubs or sports, or they're working or doing something. So you're interacting with people all day long. And when you get home, most of the time you just want to like relax, or like you definitely don't want to go out and interact with your neighbors for like more time, because you're tired and you just want to like use the time in your home that you work so hard to make as like your space. And then when everyone feels like that, it just causes like the neighborhood to feel very like internalized, and you don't really explore or ever discover anything new about your neighbors. Like next to me, I have this family that moved here in my neighborhood 2 years ago. They have a 3-year-old and they have just like, I think a man and a woman in their 30s. And the man is a part of the Durham City Council, and the woman works in retail housing. And I've never seen them go outside. Like, I have not once seen their face, I think, in the past 3 months, because they get home at like 7 or 8, and then they just are not social because they're tired. And I feel like that's true for a lot of adults. Most adults are always interacting with people at their jobs, interacting with people throughout the day, and they come home to their families. They're like, sometimes they don't even want to interact with their family. Like my mom, after a long day of work, she works sometimes 13 hours, 12 hours in a day. She just like goes and like lays down on her bed, or like almost falls asleep right when she gets home, 'cause she's so tired. She doesn't want to interact with her family, let alone go set up a giant neighborhood interaction to go bring the community closer together, 'cause they're tired. So I feel like kind of the busyness of everybody's life, and the big stress in social media and in school and in general, to like always be active and always be growing and working hard, like the idea of the grind, like, you know, go out, you make a ton of money, you know, get in shape, go to the gym, do well at school, don't stop, keep working. It takes away from community building, because then when you do have time to rest, it's time to rest. Some people even say, you know, grind when you're resting, you know, rest hard. Okay, I'm going to rest hard, but then when am I going to be social? There's no time to be social, especially in my neighborhood, because, you know, my neighbors are also doing all this hard work, so.
I have a perfect example of this somewhat disconnect within the neighborhood. I have a friend in my neighborhood who I met last year, and I found out he'd been living in my neighborhood for 11 years, and the first time I saw him was last summer, and all it took was a Frisbee jersey making party for my team over the summer.
Who was it?
His name was Kent.
He went to Colorado with us.
He's a great guy. But it took me 11 years to find out he lived in the same neighborhood as me.
Well, Hunter and I also grew up in the same neighborhood. And I don't think we knew each other.
No.
We were really little, but
for like 2 or 3 years, we lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
And there's even in our neighborhood, there was a giant park, like, down the road from my house that so many people went to. So there's a chance we actually did meet each other at some point.
And also, the thing about this is my neighborhood is relatively small and isolated, so a lot of people know each other. So this
came as a shock.
This came as a very big shock.
What do you think about the idea of... So my grandpa, on my mom's side, lives in this neighborhood where it's like a neighborhood around a little city. Like, it's in Orlando, but there's like a few shops and like a restaurant and a park. And it's like they made it on purpose so that there would be community and everything would be walkable. What do you think about these like little neighborhoods that aren't just houses, but are also businesses and parks, and it's walkable, so there's less driving? Do you think that that's a good thing to search towards?
Yes. I feel like it, in a way, it benefits everyone, as it brings together community within the neighborhood, and also benefits the business owners who have built their businesses within the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
as they're guaranteed customers, and the neighborhood is guaranteed a place where they can all gather and meet up with friends.
Yeah,
I would say overall it's not a bad thing. The only downside I can really see is if you start creating businesses and you start creating recreational areas around neighborhoods, that will cause a lot more traffic And so it will kind of take away from the, like, isolation that a lot of people prefer. Like, the creation of the suburbs was purely to take neighborhoods away from the city. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if we bring the city back to the neighborhoods, it is not necessarily bad, but just a different outlook on neighborhoods themselves. And I think it brings both good and bad to the table.
What if you imagine that there was just a parking lot outside of the neighborhood and everything inside of the neighborhood was walkable? Do you think that'd be good?
I feel like it would be very hard to achieve, but the idea sounds good. The idea of a parking area for your entire neighborhood, and then, like, you go in, gives me, like, an idea of, like, a college dorm, and then, like, shops inside. That's kind of where my mind goes.
Like a college campus.
Right, like a college campus.
That sounds fun. I mean,
It sounds nice, but it all depends on, like, what environment people want to raise their children in. I think from a realistic viewpoint, you're not going to achieve that in a full family neighborhood. You're not going to be able to create that kind of environment. But if you were to, I do think it would have positive impacts on community and community growth.
That neighborhood that I lived in is almost exactly like that. And the reason it worked is because it was student housing, so it was, like, funded by the university, and the reason the businesses could be there was because they were also supporting all the students and stuff. And it was really the experience there. I just had so many friends, and my parents had so many friends, and it's really a problem nowadays, especially for adults and adult men. They have, like, zero or one friends outside of their work, and it's a problem that I think needs to be solved, because it's important to have friends. Like, there's more and more research showing that how important having friends not only is just to, like, having fun, but also to be healthy and not be lonely. It's fine to be, like, a family man, but having friends is also good. And so I wonder what you guys think about how we should achieve that, having more friends as adults.
One thing that I've noticed as, you know, people in my life have gotten older, there's a lot of, like, relating to neighborhoods, there's, like, classifications of neighborhoods, I think it really takes away from, you know, the meeting new people. And I think that's, like, the best way to make friends. So it's like, just like my friend I met in Colorado, like, because I went to this tournament that was for people all over the world. It wasn't just people in North Carolina. I've gone to so many tournaments, just East Coast, just North Carolina, that, you know, I don't meet that many people who I enjoy, because there's just not, you know, I know all these people and I'm like, you know, you're okay, but I'm not closest friends with you. So for an example is, like, my grandma, she turned 64, 65, and her husband is 73, and they moved into, like, a senior only neighborhood. And, like, that sounds like it would be a good idea, right? And seniors only, like, you can't live there, I don't think, if you're under 50. Like, it's just part of the rules of the HOA. And it sounds cool. And then when we go visit them and we see their neighbors, everyone is mean. And, like, all the neighbors are, like, old and cranky and hate kids because they want to come to a neighborhood where it's just, you know, old people who are like them. But then they're also mean to each other because they're not meeting these new people and seeing these new outlooks on life. They, like, develop that their life is the right life, and they're so old that I'm just going to be stubborn and put up with it. And it really takes away from, like, the kindness of having a community of people of all types. And when I went there, I was like, oh, I don't want to stay here. Like, I could never live in this neighborhood. Everyone was like, I don't know. They just, like, nobody was accepting or inviting at all. And there's also, I've noticed neighborhoods where it's, like, families only. I've heard about those. I've heard of neighborhoods where it's, like, I know there's, like single woman only. And like, there's HOAs that have neighborhoods specifically for groups of people. Or, like, there's, like, you know about Chinatowns, like, or, like, neighborhoods where it's specifically for Indians only. And, like, the classification, it's not segregation because it's their choice to live there and it's a business, you know? They're allowed to do that. And then people move there thinking that it's going to help them grow closer to their type of community, but then it ends up just taking away from these aspects of life and the ability to make new friends in that neighborhood, just like we're talking about with the dads and the middle-aged men who don't have friends because they move to these new neighborhoods where they may not like people in that new neighborhood, but since that's supposed to be their community, they just stay there and end up not having anyone.
I agree. I think this kind of idea of self-segregation does happen a lot.
I think there are a lot of moments where people move in neighborhoods with a lot of people similar to them because they think that will help them better fit in. But I think what we forget is that the only thing that makes us interesting is our unique ideas and our unique viewpoints on life and like things like that. So when we try and cram a bunch of very similar people into one small space, it can get boring and people won't make friends. The whole idea of specifically middle-aged men not having a lot of friends makes sense when you think about what JD was originally saying, the idea of the grind. People are working their 9-to-5. They're getting home. They are tired. They have their family that they sometimes don't even want to deal with because they've worked the entire day. And so they don't put in the energy or the time to go out, like have events. My dad, he was bouncing between an entrepreneur to working in housing to renting out houses. And he has not had a stable salary in a long time. And he makes time not only for his work, which he puts so much work into, but also his family, and still has repeating events. Every Friday he has something he calls family dinner, where he invites a bunch of his friends over and they all come over and have dinner at the house.
That sounds awesome.
It's like a small party.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you guys are really striving for in life, and then also what you think when you're old you're going to say is your most proudest moment, and then also what you think has the strongest correlation to happiness throughout your life. It could be money, friends, like accolades. I wonder what you think about what you're going to be proud of at the end of your life.
So this is a big question, so I'm going to break it down a little bit. The first part is, what are you striving for in mm-hmm. life? I don't really know exactly what I want to do, mm-hmm. and I mean, that's fine. I'm a sophomore in high school. I got some time. But just as a personal philosophy, what I want to strive for in life is just kindness, and just to show kindness to people as much as I can. Because a little kindness can go a long way.
Yeah, I agree with what Patty's saying. Striving, what you strive for in life is definitely a big, big loaded question. I would say a main thing I strive for is having a positive impact on those around me. Mm. I think affecting those who I interact with in a good, positive way is definitely something I want to happen. I don't want to leave this world having left a negative impact, because then I feel like there's almost no point. If there is any point in life itself, I think that would be to ensure that everyone who is a part of it enjoys it.
So if you were prioritizing what job you got, do you think that you would choose the job that helped more people or the job that paid more?
I feel like I would try and find a good balance. I mean, I need money to support myself and my family and my friends, but I also, like I was saying, I want to help others. It's not like helping others isn't just something I'm like, oh yeah, I gotta do that. It's like, it's not something I have to do to seem like a good person. That's something I want to do. That's something I want to like have in a part of my life. Like I said, my dad works in housing because he wants to give people houses. He wants to get people off the streets. So I would say I would preferably find a good balance. If it came down to it and I had two options and they were both good, I would pick the one that helps people more.
I think in terms of helping versus money, I've worked three different jobs at the age of 16, and all three of them have like been helping people in some way. Some of them have been more. For example, I worked in physical therapy, but I also worked in construction. And it's not necessarily which one helps people more like on paper, but it's more like how you go about the job and how you interact with people day to day that I feel like is really how it makes a difference. Because helping people is not just something that like sounds like it would be good, but it, for me personally, it makes me feel good. It makes me like want to go to work. It makes me want to talk to other people. The interaction and seeing people be happy or seeing them improve, like through physical therapy, when we help someone and they have an injury and we see them, you know, get stronger and we see them, their life get better because of that and their life change and they're being able to spend more time with their family or do more things they couldn't do before. Like we teach people to walk sometimes because, you know, they've been in wheelchairs their whole life and they had surgeries and they finally need to be able to walk. And it makes you feel really good, and it's a big motivating factor for going in every day. And if I had a bunch of different jobs and they all paid close to the same, I would pick the one that I felt most most able to help people in, regardless of whether it said I could help them on paper. Like, if I had a job as like a surgeon and a job as a physical therapist, even if they paid the same, you know, those two jobs both help people a lot, like help people a ridiculous amount, just in different ways. I might pick the job as a physical therapist because I'm more comfortable talking to people socially and doing these things, and versus a surgeon is more like formal and strict. Money is like, it's so temporary. And like, when I'm old and like looking back on life, I want to remember helping people because I know that's the thing that's going to make me feel good more than just temporarily. Like, I can remember times I helped people with physical therapy from like 3 years ago, mm-hmm. versus just like, you know, making like a lot of money in 1 week.
I think JD's comparison between a surgeon and a physical therapist was really good, a really good way to split up helping people, because there is physically helping someone, curing a disease of theirs, and then there is helping build someone back up and like restore their faith in themselves. Mm-hmm. Like a physical therapist can take someone who has been in a wheelchair their entire life, has only ever dreamed of walking, to running across streets in glee. They're showing them new experiences. They're pushing them into a new aspect of life they've never seen before. They're opening up new worlds to them. And I think that is a whole new level of helping someone than giving them a new arm, replacing their heart, whatever it is you do. I think they're both very varied levels of helping, but it really depends on, like JD was saying, which way of helping you feel more comfortable in.
Yeah, and it's like your personality, because maybe you're not comfortable speaking to that many people and interacting with people that socially. Maybe you don't want to know about their personal life, but you want to help them in some other way that is less, like, maybe less social or less obvious. But it's all about your intentions. You know, like, if you are less comfortable because, I don't know, you just grew up as a more isolated person and you're less comfortable, then yeah, go take that surgeon job, because that is how you're going to help people in that way of life. Like, people remember their surgeons. They remember having a good surgeon. They're not going to forget the person that, you know, took out their deadly tumor. And that saves their life. That's honestly, some arguments, that could be more important than just helping them walk. You save their life. It's just all about how you want to go about it. And it's honestly what gives you the most motivation in life, in my opinion, because going through life positively is so, so much easier than going through life, oh, I have to go to work today, I have to get up tomorrow. It's just, oh, I get to get up, I get to go help people. And so it's whatever gives you that, I get to help people, I get to feel good helping people, that is like what you really want to strive for in a job or in general.
I feel like there's a lot of people who lose sight of that and just go for money, and then nice. When you look back on your life, you're not going to be as satisfied. And even if you ask them when they were old, they would not say money. And if you ask them now, really seriously, they might say that what they're striving for is not money. But you still like get in your head, I want to get a job that pays a lot of money, because that's what kind of the world tells you, like, you need to make money. And then that's also kind of like just the, if you don't think about it deeply, it's just like the feeling, like, I want to have money so I can buy things. And I think that we need to not lose sight of the fact that what we're really should be striving for is not money, but helping people. And like Hunter said, having a positive impact on the world.
Materialism.
I got one question though. What if it's, I want to have money so I can help people?
Yeah. There's people.
Philanthropy.
Yeah. There's people who spend their whole life just trying to make as much money as possible to help people who are like dying. And it's a tough question, like, how do you justify paying whatever it is, like, if college costs $50,000 and you're going to a top institution, how do you justify paying that much money for college when some organizations, some nonprofits, places you would donate to, say that they can save a life with only $5,000? How can you justify going to college for $50,000 rather than saving 10 people's lives?
I mean, we live in a capitalist society. We have created a sort of, like, I don't know exactly the word I'm looking for, but we've put money on a silver platter and we have put it on a pedestal above our heads, and it sits there, and it is the main driver, like you were saying, for a lot of people's lives. Money has kind of moved into society so soundly that it becomes all people care about. We tend to forget that the way we achieve things and the way, like, we move forward isn't through money, it's through actions. P-
people, we think, oh, I can't do that. That's going to cost this much. No, it's going to take this much time for this many people to do it. If people share a vision, money isn't a problem. Money only becomes a problem when we're interacting with other people. So I think money as a concept, it allows for these huge societies to form. But when society gets to the point that the U.S. and many other societies are in, where money plays such a big role in how you live, if you live, it kind of breaks the purpose of it, which was to help originally.
It really isolates people because it gives the idea that, you know, you have this much money for yourself, for your family. Like, you have this much money. Oh, you want to build a public community? Okay, I need to give this much. You need to get this much. It's not, we need to give our time and our action together to build something as a community. It's, I need to personally give my own sacrifice. Everyone's giving their own personal sacrifices through money versus we're all going to work together as not a sacrifice, but as hard work and build something better. It really just creates the idea of isolationism and I feel like separates people and obviously there's feelings of greed or just the desire for money.
Here in the U.S., we've really kind of shifted to making as much money as possible as like the top achievement in life. And like, the American dream was from rags to riches. And I feel like as time has progressed, it hasn't exactly gone from rags to riches. It's gone to, I want to make as much money as possible. And I don't care what it takes. And I feel like that overall is damaging as people aren't thinking about others. They aren't thinking about a community as a whole. They're just thinking about themselves.
Yeah, I agree with Patty. It's like what you were originally saying about how can someone justify spending $50,000 on college when some companies say they can save a life with $5,000. People have started to see money as a tool for themselves, something they can use to better themselves. They have stopped seeing money for the like universal, I don't even know what to call it. Like money is the wrench that can like tighten the
bounds of society.
I don't know, I'm losing it. But I think my overall point was just that like people have started to see money as something to help them and like as a way to better themselves. I get money, I can get myself a better house, I can get myself a better car, better clothes, better shoes. I can get this thing that I want, I can get this thing that I want, I can go to this place that I want, I can attend the college that I want to.
I feel like a good comparison is the idea of the railroad problem. And it's like, how do you justify spending, like, how do you $50,000 when you could save 10 people's lives? It's like, well, I don't know those 10 people, you know, they're random people. So it takes away the idea of human life and like you don't know these people, so they're just there. And you know, I would rather go spend it on myself and like know that I can help people, because it gives me a greater sense of self-worth and it gives me that idea that, oh, I know I'm gonna go be happier in life because I'm gonna go be able to help people, I'm gonna go make more money. That I can then, oh, it's like, oh, I'll pay it back later. I'll go save 10 people's lives in the future when I make more money. And because you don't know those 10 people, like the value of their lives takes away, just like the idea of the train problem. If you pull that lever, you're going to kill one person that you know, but if you don't, it's going to kill five people that you don't know. Most people don't pull the lever because they don't know the five people. And if they don't pull it, it wasn't never their fault. Just like if those 10 people die, it was never their fault. You know, it just happened. So.
Well, that kind of brings us to one of the main fields of philosophy, utilitarianism. So let me just explain it, and then you can talk about your outlook on it. So utilitarianism, according to the principle of utility, we should always do whatever will produce the greatest amount of happiness and whatever is necessary to prevent the greatest amount of unhappiness. However, oftentimes that justifies crazy things, and I wonder if you think that this is like a universal principle of utility and we should just always care about what maximizes happiness and minimizes unhappiness, or if there's some fundamental rights that we can't violate. For example, imagine you have five patients and four of them are missing critical organs that they need to survive, and they're going to die if they don't get them. And there's no organ donors. There's nothing you can do to save them. No one has been willing to give up an organ. However, a healthy patient walks in to your doctor's office. Is it just to kill them, harvest their organs, and save four people for one person? Because utilitarianism would say that that maximizes the amount of people who are alive. But other people would say that people have a fundamental right not to just be killed. Like, it's their choice whether to save other people, not someone else's choice to kill them to save other people. So I wonder if you think that the principle of utility, where we should always do whatever maximizes happiness, minimizes unhappiness, is correct, or if we have some sort of fundamental rights that stop that from being true.
I think that is a flawed viewpoint. I think the idea of maximizing happiness is just overall not only extremely hard to gauge, but also would lead to extreme scenarios.
It's impossible. Right. Can't maximize happiness.
For example, let's say there was a family. No one really knew them. They didn't really interact with many people in their community. And you know that there's another family who's looking for a house to move into. Would you give all that whole family that no one really knows or talks to or cares about a quick silent death? They don't feel unhappy. And you move in a new family who starts to spread happiness in their new home. That would maximize happiness, but what have you done? You've killed a family.
Well, in a way, it wouldn't maximize happiness because that other family that lived there would have had more happiness if they had survived. So maybe they didn't have unhappiness, but it did take away their potential happiness. So
that's what I'm saying. How do you gauge happiness?
It's really hard.
I feel like utilitarianism is a very overgeneralized philosophical viewpoint that's flawed. As you said, you cannot measure happiness. There's no way to say...
There's no direct measurement.
There's no direct. You can't say, I am at the very peak happiness because I'm happy right now. You can't say that.
There's always more.
There's always more. And you can't say that. You can't justify the means to maximize happiness. Everyone has certain rights that should not be violated. And...
Like what?
You should, like you said in your example, if you walk into a doctor's office, you shouldn't be killed.
Even to save other people.
The right to
live. If you walked into a doctor's office and you're completely healthy, you should be asked first. You shouldn't just be killed.
Hey, man.
You want to die and harvest your organs?
Can we harvest
your organs, right? Yeah. In the next 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Are there any other fundamental rights that any of you guys think exist that we just can't violate?
I think the idea of fundamental rights stems from the idea of, like, society's ideas on what we deserve as people, like the requirements to live. You could argue in the U.S. one of the fundamental rights, you could argue, are the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, the freedom of protest. Like, those are rights given to people by the government. They think humans have these rights. But in 400 years or 400 years ago, those rights looked very different. Women didn't even have the right to vote, read, like talk in public about their, like, what they believe and their opinions for the longest time in history. In the past, they would have argued that those were the fundamental rights of men and women. So I think the idea of fundamental rights is very relative, and what humans require is very relative.
But what do you think? It could be relative, but, like,
I think there are no direct fundamental rights. I think there isn't.
None. Then how do you justify not killing the person to save four people if there aren't fundamental rights?
I think that everyone I think one right that everyone is just the right to their own body. Like, you should have the decision. I feel like you have the decision. Like you said, that person has the right to their organs when they walk into that hospital. They should not be killed to maximize happiness.
I'm not saying I don't have any fundamental rights. I don't think people have things that they are deserving of and are obliged to off birth. I'm saying that there is no correct fundamental right, because any viewpoint on the fundamental right will have changed depending on the era of society and society's overall viewpoint on that. From the viewpoint of, like, a governor, the fundamental rights of a person are extremely different from the viewpoints of someone in a cannibalistic tribe in Africa. They probably wouldn't care about any fundamental rights of anyone. Whereas a governor would have a much different interpretation of those rights. So I'm not saying that I don't have these fundamental, like, I don't believe that people do deserve things and, like, have basic rights that they should obtain. I just think that it's unrealistic to try and find the correct fundamental rights and like what are the fundamental rights, because they will never Hunter, be exact.
What do you believe that people are? He wants to talk. What do you believe that people are fundamentally?
I would answer, but I think I've talked enough, and I think JD wants to talk.
JD wants to talk.
One fundamental right that I think everyone is obliged to, and this could cancel out some other ones, is just the right to exploration and the right to creativity. Because, well, the main idea in Simon's example of the four people and the one person is the right to live, right? If that person walks in and they die, well, that's they don't have the right to live. But I think a more important one is the right to explore, because an example is North Korea. They have no internet access. They can't look up anything on the internet. It's just blocked. And the right, nobody should ever be put in this box of nobody should be chained down forever and not learn anything, because you should learn everything about the world and whatever you want to learn. And then what you choose to do with that information is your choice. If you go and explore and then you choose to kill a bunch of people, you choose to go on a mass murdering streak, well, then your right to live might be taken away. That was your choice, because you explored what you could do in life, and then that's the results that come with your actions.
Fucked around and found out.
Yeah. But nobody should inherently from birth be limited to learning nothing and just be chained down, and because at that point, what's the point of life? If you're not going to learn anything, if you're just going to exist, we're no better than a bug or a bee.
So you're saying the right to freedom and the right to...
It's not even necessarily freedom.
Public schools?
It doesn't have to be public schools. You can educate yourself.
Exploration, curiosity.
The right to be able to, because your freedom could also be taken away. If you choose to kill people or you choose to child molestation or something, you're in jail. And that's not, you don't have any freedom anymore. It got taken away. But that was your choice because you learned about that stuff in life. So I guess the right to, at least until maybe age 5, be brought up by a parent and then have the ability to teach yourself things, that should be just something that everyone has. And then once you, after that, what you choose to do in life is your choice. And there might be results that come with that or consequences of your actions. But
so how is this different than freedom?
Because freedom states that everyone should inherently be
unbound.
Be able to do whatever they want, which might not be true because there are consequences to what you do.
Are you saying freedom implies lack of consequences and curiosity and exploration?
Yeah, I think freedom is used too generally, especially in modern times, because when somebody does something illegal, they're like, I have the right to freedom. This should be allowed. And it's like, no, you have the right.
It's a free country.
Yeah, it's a free country. I can do whatever I want. When you're doing something that's not only legally wrong, but also morally wrong. So I think there's a big difference between freedom and exploration, curiosity.
What do you think is the role of the government? Do you think that, because there is, in a sense, that the government could limit your freedom? For example, American citizens for the longest time were not allowed to go to Cuba, I think. So that's, in a way, limiting what you can do. But it's also kind of for your own good. And another example, they're called paternalist or something like that. Paternalist policies, you're not allowed to have certain drugs,
drive your car without,
including marijuana, which people really seatbelt on. Do you think that the government is overstepping their role when they do that in restricting your curiosity or your freedom or whatever you want to say, restricting what you can do, not to save other people, but to save you from yourself? Do you think that shouldn't be allowed, or people or the government can enforce things for your own good?
I think the government can enforce things for your own good to some extent, because you can still learn about those things and the consequences of your actions. It's more like if you're not allowed to learn. Imagine the person in North Korea, like I talked about. They're not allowed to learn what marijuana does or allowed to use it. That's too far. They should either be allowed to use it or allowed to learn about what it does. But you can't have you can't take away both. And if the government knows that people aren't allowed to do those things, but they can know what it does, then at least you know what it does. And then if you choose to go behind the government's back or, do something illegal because you want to, because you learned about it, well, then that's still you can do that because you know about it. But if you don't have either, there's just lack of complete knowledge of the existence of the thing because you're not allowed to do it or know about it.
that's so in a way, this is more similar to like freedom of speech than to being free, because like if other people can have freedom of speech, then they can tell you everything.
Yeah.
So like a freedom of knowledge.
Freedom of the mind.
Not the government doesn't like restrict what you're allowed to know. And do you think there are exceptions to that? For example, like classified documents, which if released to the public would be bad for national security. Do you think that that is an okay exception to restricting your knowledge?
I mean, who deems the level of which a document like would do that?
The government. And do you think that's just for them to do that?
I mean, the government in itself is a flawed system. Having a perfect government is using the word perfect, it's impossible. But having a government that works in the exact will of the people, which is what I assume the U.S. strives to achieve, government of the people for the people, does not always work correctly, as seen by the current government. You have a two-party system, and both parties do their best to alienate the other, make it seem horrible, make it seem bad. That doesn't seem like a government of the people for the people. That seems like a government of, like, congressmen and governors arguing with each other.
I feel like that, as you said, classified documents. I feel like if the classified documents infringe on the rights of the people that the government has given them, then they should... then they should not be classified, as seen with Edward Snowden and the NSA, when the NSA was spying on every single citizen, U.S. citizen, that had a telephone, and they weren't telling people that they were doing that. And that was infringing on people's rights, their right to privacy.
Like private information.
Okay, wait, but if
they're spying.
Is there a fundamental right to privacy?
If it's the rights... If it's the rights that the government gives them... Well, how could the government ever infringe on their own rights?
Well, they don't care. To serve the people. Well, I mean, the idea of the government is to serve the people, right?
That's why I'm saying government majority.
I feel like if the the idea of the government is to serve the people. So if they are not serving the people, then they are infringing on the rights that they gave them. So they're breaking their own rules.
We could do a part two sometime, because I've done that before, and it seems like we're still talking, but. We do want to get to lunch.
We're
going
to have to take a quick snack break.
Yeah. Start playing
ASMR before we go.
Simon, start playing that elevator music.
Ready?
Yeah, the elevator music is going to kick in soon. See you next time.